Good morning, everyone. My name is Rafael Tamayo, manager of the Oak Cliff Cultural Center. You are listening to OC3 Frequencies, a podcast by the Oak Cliff Cultural Center. We are a division of the City of Dallas Office of Arts and Culture. And today we have a legend in the building with us. I told, you know, we as a staff, we talked about it earlier and we narrowed it down to 100 questions. So we only have 100 questions to ask the artist. But before we jump into our conversation, we're going to let our staff introduce themselves.
Hey, I'm Andrea Tostin, Cultural Programs Coordinator.
Iris Bechtel, Gallery Programs Coordinator.
And without further ado, let's dig in. Let's get into the most probing questions that we can think of and discover everything we can about the artist. And I'll let Iris give the introduction.
Okay, y'all. I don't know how we made this happen, but we made it happen.
Yes.
Today on the podcast, we have Jose Vargas. On the eve of his solo exhibition here at the Oak Cliff Cultural Center, Retro Matico Tres, which opens Saturday night, that's tomorrow, from 6 to 8 p.m. Please come out, or I guess this podcast won't come out before then.
It might, but that's a tall order.
That's a tall order for Rafa. So if you're listening to this, come out and see the show, and hopefully you didn't miss the reception. Jose is a very, very active visual artist. If you do not know him, you should try to come to the show and get to know him. He's got a lot of great stories about being an artist and just living the life. He has been making work since the 70s, and he has participated in over, which I believe is probably more than this, but he says over 170 exhibitions, but I'm going to say like probably 200. He's collaborated with numerous other art organizations besides the Oak Cliff Cultural Center. In 2015, he started an art exchange program with La Galería de la Misión de Sinicu, an art gallery and museum in El Paso, Texas. In addition to being a practicing artist, he has been curating art exhibitions for over 30 years in Dallas, including the annual El Corazón and the La Virgen de Guadalupe shows. Both of those are going to be opening or have opened, and one is going to be opening soon in January. The Virgen show is at the Latino Cultural Center currently, and the El Corazón will be at the Bath Coast House Cultural Center in January, correct?
Yes.
Correct. Vargas not only practices as an artist and a curator, but also has worked as a gallery coordinator previously at the Ice House Cultural Center, which was kind of the predecessor for the Oak Cliff Cultural Center. And he provides a lot of gallery assistance at the Bath House Cultural Center and the Latino Cultural Center by installing shows. And he's excellent at that, and he's very meticulous about it. Welcome to the show, Jose.
Thank you. Thank you. It's nice to be here. I think, you know what, Richard just ended right there. I mean, it sounds good to me. Thank you all for listening. It's been a pleasure.
You know, if there was a podcast version of something that we could put out there that would be representative of you, this would be one component of it. We could end it right there and say, this is our podcast with Jose.
And the it would, end. Come to the show.
And I know people would like, I can hear Gerardo saying, man, that's so Jose. That's so Jose.
No, actually, if you don't mind, what I found interesting when you were saying, when you started that we have 100 questions, I just thought about something. When I start installing shows, you know, people come in and either they're going to drop off the artwork or whatever. And I, the first thing I say to them, there's that 3-question limit. They go, what do you mean? I go, that's one. And they're looking at me like, what's going on? I go, that's two. and so they're confused. And I said, look, let's say I'm dealing with 60 artists, right? Each artist comes in and they go, oh, who did that? Who did that? I'm not going through this with 60 artists, you know. Plus, you know, later on when the show is open, you know, you have somebody coming in and say, is so-and-so here or who did this artwork? I said, no. That's why I said, you know what, I'm just going to limit it to 3 questions and that's it. you know, but I give it to everybody. Anybody that goes to the room, you got three. That's three questions. That's it. So, but anyways, I just thought that's so the sort of thing that I think about.
I think that's very right generous. Yeah. It's very generous. So, do we get more than three questions?
Yeah, y'all get more than three.
I haven't asked mine yet, so don't get anything. With that, asking and you know, having 60 artists, three questions each, that's 180 questions that you have to answer. And that's saying that they only ask three questions each. We almost 100% get more than three questions, right? Mm-hmm. Would you say that sometimes you're kind of performing, like you're a performing artist, like you're doing theater?
Well, actually, it turns out that I didn't realize that I've been doing it my entire life. Mm-hmm. You know, but it just depends who you're talking to and who you really don't want to talk to. You know, are you speaking to somebody that you respect, somebody you care about, or are you speaking to a cop that maybe is angry that day? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't know. It just really depends. But also, what I've realized that a lot of times, it's just, you know, if you get to know me, you're gonna think, man, it's just a grumpy old man. I go, hell, I got reasons for that. But sometimes you have to put those things aside and realize that, you know, you're speaking to, you know, human beings, and some of them, they're, you know, they are kind, and you just have to kind of, you know, slow down and listen to them and you know, and just listen to them and kind of try to be halfway nice, you know. And other times, even though I might be in a mad mood, I have to pull myself out and mm-hmm. yeah. But sometimes it is a performance, because, you know, like, let's say I would rather go like, oh, I want to break something, but you don't really want to do that. You just go, just be nice and smile and say thank you, you know, that sort of a thing. And then, we, you know, it just goes on. But it's not always a performance. But yeah, you're right. Sometimes I feel like, yeah, I sort of have to be. Yeah, you know, I'm just kind of put on the spot, yeah. You know. But sometimes I enjoy it, and other times, I don't know. I'm just trying to get stuff done, and, you know.
I will say, it's, I think it's a good thing, because I appreciate your honesty and you're a fairly upfront person, but I will say that sometimes I don't know if you were upset, if you're okay, or if you're happy with any particular thing that you're saying, just because I've never seen you get very extreme with your emotions on either side, whether good or bad. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that's a, you know, it can be a scary thing for someone that doesn't know you. But, you know, I've had a lot of time to, you know, kind of talk about your experiences mm-hmm. and some of the things that you've gone through. So some of the stories you have are really funny. Mm-hmm. But when you tell some of those stories, they don't really sound a whole lot different than the tone you have when an artist makes you upset about something. Or if you're like, well, you know, this artist, after I asked them repeatedly to have it hang ready, there are no D-rings on this. And so you do a very good mm-hmm. job of keeping yourself within this this kind of presentational mm-hmm. Jose Vargas that we all see.
I want to, you know, earlier today we had a group and Raphael asked me to say a couple of things about the Five Windows exhibition that's in the multipurpose studio. And then we walked over to see your exhibition, and, you know, they had a lot of questions about your work. And so we talked a little bit, mostly about you as a person as an artist and your practice, rather than individual pieces. But one of the things I mentioned is that you're really generous with artists. From what I've heard from other artists who talk about you very fondly, and I think, you know, you telling them like, well, you need to have D-rings on this, you need to have the proper hardware on the back, I think is a way of you kind of teaching them. And, you know, what I've heard from other artists is that you're continuously encouraging them. You give them good feedback. If you don't, I remember, you know, we've had conversation and you said, well, even if I don't accept a work into, you know, one of the shows that I'm curating, I give the artists feedback and tell them why. And mm-hmm. I think that's really important. Myself as a curator, I don't do that very often. And it's something that it's very hard to do, right? Because people don't usually want to hear someone else's opinion, But so I think in that way, it's like really you being, rather than you being like upset with them that they don't have it, you know, done the right way, it's like you saying, no, like, here, I'm helping you. I'm teaching you how to do it the right way so that you can go, you know, to the next show or the next curator or, you know, and have it done right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I understand it because I like what you're saying. And yeah, you're right. But I see it as it's helping me and it helps that person, mm-hmm. you know. But you're right. A part of it is I'm trying to educate them. But at the same time, I'm trying to get them just to do better. So next time I don't have to deal with it, you know, and the next person doesn't have to deal with it.
Yes.
And I do explain to them. But unfortunately, see, now I'm going to this other direction. Unfortunately, let me see, I don't even know how many shows I've hung over the last few years. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, every time some work comes in, I mean, you could guarantee, you could put a $100 bill on the table and say, I'm assuming 3 or 4 or 10 or 12 pieces are going to come in that are incorrect for one way or the other, even though mm-hmm. I did specify when I organized shows, all artwork must be done in a proper, this particular way, ready for hanging, wires, you know, proper wires, proper mm-hmm. D-ring, same thing. And sure enough, something comes in is just, it's just totally wrong. And I, over the years, I tried to be a little bit more relaxed about it, you know, but, and sometimes I do say, you know what, this isn't going to work. And I'll tell you why. And I go, would you mind taking it home and fixing it? Or just, here's the table over there. And then sometimes if they don't know how to do that, I have actually have classes, a short little 5 to 10 minute class, and have 3 or 4 people going, this is why you use the D-ring. This is how you do it. This is how mm-hmm. you measure it. And all of it, where you're going, you have to drill in there. You have to know how to drill, what kind of a drill, how far to go in. Does, you know, everything involved, you know, the screws, the screwdriver, the wire, if you're going to mm-hmm. use the wire, why are you using it, the thickness of the wire, all of that involved, which is really a lot. But once you do it a few times, it's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. You don't kind of almost not even think about it, you just know what happens. But I've dealt with so many pieces that, or I'm going, this is not going to work. There's no mm-hmm. way for me to hang it. It's impossible for me to hang it. But I like things done a certain way only because, honestly, I'm selfish. I'm thinking of myself. I want things to run smoothly for me. If I have to stop and fix something, I'm going, wait a minute. I'm taking 20 minutes or longer to fix one item in 20 minutes. I could have hung 3 pieces. I would have been ahead by this time. See what I'm saying? So sometimes, I don't know. It's just one of those things. But you know, it's never going to go away, you know. mm-hmm. You know, and that part, oh, and I don't know why you didn't ask me, but I just thought of it too. When pieces come in, and let's say a person has a canvas and there's no frame, mm-hmm. the edges are white, and I go, oh, you know what? I'm going to point out that the edges are white. You know, only you understand why that is, but I'm going to tell you, I really prefer for them not to be white. And I explained to him, I said, well, first of all, it looks like it's unfinished. Now, I know mm-hmm. I've heard from other people where they go, well, my professor said, I'm going, well, screw your professor. I know better. In fact, if you want me to, I'll even talk to him. Mm-hmm. But I'm telling you, I don't know why he asked you to do that, but I'm telling you, he's wrong. This is the best way I feel from my experience because mm-hmm. it just makes it look more professional, mm-hmm. finished. And, you know, if you don't have a frame for it, I understand there's all kinds of reasons for it. You didn't have time. You don't have the money. All of these situations. But mm-hmm. again, I just try to make things look better because, one, it's a show that I've organized. And some people, I guess mm-hmm. people, I don't know if they understand or not, when a person organizes a show, it's like you have a blank canvas. You're the artist. Mm-hmm. You're like the director, the producer. You go, if you have a blank canvas, you go, okay, I'm going to have a design in mind, and I want certain colors in there to make it look good. Well, to me, my art form is organizing shows and hanging the shows. In the past, I've had people come in and they smile, you know, Jose, where's your artwork? They'll go expecting me to point out a piece. I'm going, look around. Look at all the walls. All of this, I created it with the help, of course, it's not just me, of course, but the help of the other artists that were kind enough to participate, mm-hmm. produce some really good art show, and to bring it in. I said, this is my art form. So to me, that I see it as my art form, my blank canvas. So I try to make it as the best that I can, because that's the only way that I know how to do things, you know. Mm-hmm. But, and nobody brought up the subject, but yes, it can be extremely frustrating sometimes. But I try to go over, I mean, I try to just deal with it and move on. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we're really fortunate here in the city of Dallas to have city-funded cultural spaces, and you were involved in the very early beginnings of our cultural centers here. Can you talk a little bit about how you became involved and why the cultural centers are important to you?
Well, I'll say the culture centers are important to me, but they're important to everybody that's in the city, everybody that's in the state, because obviously it gives people an opportunity to come in and to look for something that is educational, and hopefully they'll enjoy it. They'll take some time away from their lives. Our lives are so hectic and so busy, and, you know, let's face it, times that we just have the most miserable day or miserable week. So sometimes if you get a chance to come and look at some art, that puts your mind in a different place. And I always find that it helps me just kind of chill out and just relax, you know. But, and honestly, I came into when the culture centers were started in Dallas, but I was fortunate enough that when I came out of the military, I believe that was in 71, I used to have a cousin that I would hang out with. She didn't have a car, so I would always take her places in my old Volkswagen that was always breaking down. But she was kind of cool. She would take me to, you know, I don't know, one of the theaters in Dallas, and she would introduce me to the people that were doing that, and then she would take me to some culture centers, introduce me to the manager and so forth. Of course, I was taking everything in, but I was sort of taking a step back because I wasn't familiar with the scene, what was going on, and with me, I've always been, I don't know if what the word for it would be, but I'm sort of like, I just stay in my head most of the time, you know. Mm. I just kind of, I'm sort of quiet sometimes and really don't say that much. And I just try to observe and, mm-hmm. you know, and see what's going on. So I guess it sort of answers your question. They took me to that particular friend of mine, my cousin, she took me to, I believe it was Teatro Dallas. And that was an eye-opener for me, mm-hmm. because, you know, I like to see Berber perform, especially in theater, because I'm going, I don't have the guts to get up there and do it. And I really appreciate when somebody else does that, you know, and it's the same thing. Your mind goes somewhere else and you're enjoying yourself. You're enjoying what they're doing. And mm-hmm. it's just beneficial to me. And of course, my cousin also, she took me to the Bathhouse Culture Center. I never heard of it. I walked in there, I saw what they were doing and I liked it. I'm going, this is good. Mm-hmm. You know, how can I get involved? You know, and that's sort of what happened, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah.
Did you start making art before you were working at the Ice House? Were you already an artist, correct?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you're speaking to a man that's 73 going on 85. I've been doing art ever since I was like, before the first grade. I used to remember getting in trouble because I always did the things that you're not supposed to do. Well, first of all, my parents didn't buy me any paintbrushes or paint or markers or anything. So I would get sharp objects and scratch on furniture, which obviously I don't recommend. Anybody listen to me, don't do that. Okay. But my little brain, it didn't stop me. It just says, oh, I want to scribble. I want to scratch. I want to make a design. So I would do that. That's what I did, you know, when I was growing up, you know, just, so I knew early on that art has an effect on people, even if it was confusing to me. I just saw that, you know. So when I was growing up, like, for example, in the third grade, Miss Whitaker, she really liked me a lot, and for some reason or another, she would invite me. She went to my parents, asked permission to take me to spend the night and the weekend at her home, and she really liked my drawings, and so she would take me to, I don't know, Turtle Creek Park or something, and I would sit out there with some crayons and I would just draw what I was seeing, ducks and watery clouds, all that kind of thing. And I really enjoyed it. But at the same time, I knew that she really liked it. So again, it goes to back to art has an effect on people. So I was aware of that at an early part of my life.
Mm-hmm. In the exhibition, and then in just in your practice in general, you work across a lot of different mediums, as many artists do now, but also across many different styles. And especially when y'all come to see this exhibit, you can see that in Jose's work. He's very versatile in terms of like technical skill, and has interest across the board from photography to sculpture to painting. To working with found objects. I know you made some, the newest works, I think that you said you've made are the photography that you've done kind of surrounding your family history. Can you talk a little bit about that work, about the newest work in the exhibition?
Yeah, I can talk about that, but I was gonna say something that you didn't bring up, which has to do with photography. But and first of all, I really want to thank you, Iris, because you gave me the opportunity to you gave me the green light, because you knew you had invited me to come in and do a show over a year ago, and you didn't tell me what I had to do. You just kind of left it open, and I'm going, wow, I'm pretty lucky, you know. I'm getting a blank. A blank wall, and they go, Jose, just do it. I'm going, yeah. All right. So, of course, I sort of wrestled with myself trying to figure out what I was going to do. But you're right, what you were talking about, I have a variety of interest in. But when you see the work, you may think of it as maybe eclectic, but I'm telling you from my point of view, that's the way my brain works. It's mm-hmm. never in one spot. It's always like at different places at the same time. You know, sort of interdimensional. And I was also going to bring up the fact that I love Photoshop. To me, human beings have created two things that I, maybe three or more, that I really, really love: air conditioning and Photoshop. Oh, and the other one is YouTube.
You know,
man, I love those things. But Photoshop to me, I know it's hard to explain, but I say this magic. It's magical. You could create whatever your mind comes up with, mm-hmm. as long as you know that, you know, the technical part, which I don't. I mean, I'm lucky if I even know 8% of what Photoshop. Can you imagine what a person can do? They know 50% of it. I've never met anybody that knows that. Anyways, but the point is, I really like using Photoshop because it allows me to go further with my artwork, trying to convey to people my ideas or my fantasies or whatever. But you asked about about some of the personal work about my family, and that's one of those things. You know, it's a very personal, and it's something that I've been wanting to do for years. But also as an artist, sometimes I feel we're sort of stuck in some place. Like, for example, especially if you're starting out, for an artist starting out, or even people that have been doing it for a number of years, sometimes you don't have the opportunity to exhibit your work in any one particular place. So you may wait for a culture center or a gallery to say, hey, we have a call for entry. What's a call for entry? Well, the theme is Dia de los Muertos. So you create artwork that fits into Dia de los Muertos. Mm-hmm. You do a corazón, you create artwork that fits into a corazón. Well, some of us create artwork that doesn't fit into those. You go, what am I going to do with it? Well, you just stick it in a closet or stick it on the wall, and after a while you kind of forget about it and you move on. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was saying that I feel really lucky that Iris allowed me to, she just gave me the green light. Which to me it kind of puts me off. I'm going, oh, I'm kind of more used to structure. You know, like I've told her before, I've done shows where, let's say, all the frames look alike, all the artwork fits together, and I don't mind doing those, but at the same time, I feel that it's sort of like your hands are tied, which I don't really like. And so I really feel lucky with this particular show because I got to do show. First of all, you get to show things that have not, some of them have never been shown before, even though I've had them for a good 20, 30, 40 years. And of course, I get to show some work that I get to play with, which, of course, like I said, Photoshop. But this time I said, you know what? I want to do things that are more personal. I want to work with some of the photos of my brother who died at 8 months of age. He was my twin brother, and I've never dealt with it, you know. I just never dealt with it in the, you know, it's just something, you know, that you have in the family albums. And unfortunately, after a while, especially like I said, I'm 73, after a while, you start losing the information. You might see pictures in a family album. You go, who's this old man? Or who's this woman? And who's this kid? And you go, I don't know. We don't know. You know, the people are getting older and they die off. So we don't have that information. But I knew from talking to my parents, and like for my mom, for example, you know, she had 16 kids. You think that's a lot? My aunt had 18. And you go, why did she have so many kids? She just kept dying off. Well, that makes sense, right? So anyway, she had three sets of twins, you know, and I'm the last of the three sets of twins, and I'm the only one that survived. Sometimes I go, and I don't know what to think about that. You know, I have really no idea what to make of that. You would think maybe, possibly there's a purpose. I have no idea, you know. Anyways, so I really like the opportunity that I get to. Oh, and by the way, you'll come and look at a photograph on display where there's a burial for my twin brother. His name was Jesus. And he's in, you know, the burial, of course, you get to see a white coffin, you know, which, and that photograph, I really, really, I don't know who took that photograph. That was done back in 1950. My sister showed it to me, and when she showed me, she had this really small photograph, and whoever had it, I think they had it in their wallet because they folded it over, they bent it in half, and they stuck it somewhere, and so you had this huge crease right in the middle. And I said, no problem. I know Photoshop. I love Photoshop. So I had somebody scan it for me. And believe it or not, it took me about 3.5 hours for me to clean it up. Mm-hmm. But I loved it. I love working for 3 hours just trying to get rid of it to where you would look at it and you go, you would never know that it had been damaged. But at the same time, I was studying the people, and most of them are relatives, you know, and I could make out who most of them are. Some of them, I don't know who they are. But I really appreciate that photograph. But again, only because, one, the photograph has done extremely well. I'm a photographer. I've been interested in photography ever since I was a kid, you know. And so that photograph has done really, really well. But I really appreciate seeing, you know, my parents and my grandmother and my aunts and uncles and that sort of thing. And I really enjoyed making it, you know, so that's part of it. And then, too, I started thinking about, you know, because I have a photograph of my mom holding my brother and myself, you know. And I always appreciated my mom, you know. And the funny part to me is, like, when I was growing up, I never thought of ourselves as Indians, you know. We just thought of ourselves, you know, just people, right? You know, and it's crazy. You grow up and somebody's calling you names, which I'm going, I was looking, I'm like, what's their problem? Like, why are they even saying that, you know? And but I didn't realize that some people, they just don't like you because of the color of your skin. Anyways, oh, and here's something else that I thought was really peculiar. I didn't realize, and this is how crazy it is, this is how naive I am at times. I didn't know that Indians spoke Spanish until like in the 70s when I was watching TV with my father. You know, we used to have a bunch of like black and white TVs and stuff. Anyways, I said, look, that Indian man, he's speaking Spanish. I didn't know Indians could speak Spanish, which is really ridiculous when you stop to think about it. But, you know, but it also kind of opened up my eyes, you know. Anyways, but the Indians were, I believe, Apache, you know. So then the more the more I started, then later on, years later, I started becoming more interested in Indians. You know, one day I thought, what's an Indian? I mean, really, I'm like, what is an Indian? I'm going, I don't know. So I said, well, you know what? I'm going to go to Mexico City and start there. There's a bunch of Indians over there, I'm assuming. Oh, and of course, I ran into a bunch of people, you know, American Indians. And then I ran into people that were somewhat historians that were talking about, you know, Comanches and Apaches and Mexican wars and all that kind of stuff that was going on in Texas. So I became more and more interested in finding out what is an Indian. Then I'm going, am I an Indian? Are my parents Indians? I think so. And then later on, I started studying my mom's face. I'm going, I never thought of her as an Indian, but if that's not an Apache, I'm going, that's an Apache. She's got strong Apache blood, you know, which I found interesting, you know. So much so that, you know, I went to Fort Sill in Oklahoma where they had Geronimo. Mm-hmm. You know, he was in prison over there, and they also they had a house for him. And so I went to see, I don't know why, I've always been interested in Geronimo. I have no idea why. I just know this fierce Indian man that would easily, you know, blow your brains out if he had a chance to. But I just found him really interesting person. Anyways, and that's why. So I went to see where he had been in prison, and I went to his gravesite. And there's some interesting stories. If you ever get a chance to check it out, like somebody stole his skull. Well, you know, it's one of those things that happens. So anyway, so back to my mom, though. I started studying her, and I'm going, wow, yeah, she just has a really nice face, you know, which I never thought of, you know, when I was growing up. You just go, hey, mom, you know, what's for breakfast, that sort, you know, that sort of a thing. But so I just decided to start working with that, you know. I think some people use the word archival, that I'm archiving these, which I never thought of. I don't use fancy words. I think I've got like a maybe 80 word vocabulary, but anyways, but I really, but I said, no, it's sort of like historical. You're trying to preserve personal family history. And now I'm just at the point where I just want to share it with people. I don't know if you know it or not, nobody's mentioned it so far, but I had a heart attack about a year and a half ago, and people were going, oh no, he's going to talk about the heart attack again. I know. That's the only one that I've had, you know. And when I was having it, I'm going, am I having a heart attack? I don't know. I've never had a heart attack before, but it sure does hurt like hell, you know. So anyway, so those kinds of things, that kind of, it shakes you up. It makes you think about things. I guess I'm more and more into doing my art now. And now that's one of the reasons why I want to share my art with people, you know, photographs of my mom and, you know, and my brother, you know, just, I don't know. It's just something that I've been meaning to do for a while, but I'm just real lucky that I'm doing it now.
Mm-hmm. Well, so if you had to estimate how many works of art you have that you've made, that you've created. Actually, no. How many works of art that you've made? Because I'm sure some people have acquired or bought some of your pieces and they're not with you anymore. But how many would you say you have produced over your long career as an artist?
Oh, you know what? It's really hard to say, but it's interesting. I'm looking at y'all. There's three of you people, you know, and you're asking me questions. I'm going, you don't understand what effect a question has, you know, because when you ask me a question, my brain is calculating in all these different areas.
Oh, I am fully aware of who I am speaking with, my good sir.
No, but I'm going to, it puts me in different areas. And I don't know, obviously, I don't know how your brain works, but my brain works in multiple spheres. And there's like videos in there, and there's audios in there, and they're all running at the same time. So when somebody asks me a question, you have to slow down, go, wait. They're asking a question, so they need an answer. Should I give them answer number one, number two, number three, number 25? You see what I'm saying? But it puts me in different spots. Like, for example, I'm not a beer-drinking man, but I like some country and western songs. I like the titles, like A Tear in My Beer. Well, what does that have to do with your question? Oh, man, I tell you what. Some of the experiences that I've gone through live, And some of those things I try to dodge only because I just don't want to break down and start crying. I don't like to do that in front of people. But it just reminds me of all the artwork that I had to leave behind, a house that when I lost my house because I was unemployed for 2.5 years. That's right, 2.5 years. I was flat broke, so I lost my house of 15 years, and I left, I don't even know how many paintings in the garage because I was so exhausted when I was moving. And, you know, and my sister, my poor sister, she says to me, she goes, Jose, are you going to take the paintings from the garage? And I went, huh? Well, I didn't even know what she was saying. I was so, like, dumbfounded, and I was extremely exhausted. You know, I was, you know, I didn't break down and cry, but I lost my house. He said, well, that's bad. Anyway, so... And I went, I don't know. You know, I was like, I don't know. So she went into the garage and she pulls out. She goes, well, what about this? I went, yeah, throw in the truck. I said, yeah. It's a paint that I had done back, I don't even know when it was, 69, 70. And, but I knew, and I didn't even want to think about it. I didn't even want to think the fact that I'm losing an entire house and the artwork, which reminds me, you see what I'm saying? That's the way my brain works, plus the fact that I have one sister, but she, one day she decided, because I'm telling you, I'm just full of stories. I used to live with my parents in Oak Cliff, and then my father bought the house next door. Get this, he bought it for $3,000. I'm not lying. He bought it for $3,000.
You shouldn't have said that to me, man.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah, so because the city was going to tear it down, so he got a great deal on it. Mm-hmm. Of course, I helped him. I mean, I worked my butt on that thing without air conditioning, but that's a different story. Anyways, so I lived there for a few years, and then I met my future ex-wife, so I started hanging out with her, and, you know, so I ended up moving to other parts of Dallas, but I left my stuff in the house because, well, I went to store it, I didn't have a storage unit, so I decided to put everything in a room. Well, one day, the sister that's dead, she got in her mind that she was just going to do somebody a favor, not me. And so I just decided to put all of my belongings out on the front curb. So I get a phone call from one of my other sisters. She goes, man, you better get to the house. Why? I'm going to just put your crap all over the... Not, she didn't use the word crap, but she put your stuff all over the curb and people were picking up. And what? Are you kidding me? So I ran over there and I'm going, no, get away from that stuff. Get away, leave it alone. It's mine. So I had to put everything back in there, but it was already too late. Mm. And a friend of mine gave me a pig that was given to her by Stevie Ray Vaughan. He gave it to her right as he was walking out. So when I went to visit her in Austin, she goes, hey, Jose, hold out your hand, close your eyes. I'm going, why? She goes, I'm going to give you something. I'm going, is it going to hurt? Because, you know, that's why I just expect things like that. Mm-hmm. She goes, no. What is it? She goes, and I'm going, wow, that thing's light. She goes, open up your eyes. I'm going, wow, it's a pig. It's a Stevie Ray Vaughan. She goes, yeah. I go, where'd you get it? She goes, Stevie gave it to me. I go, what? Yeah. He came into the shop because she was a manager in Austin. He came into the shop, he and his wife, he goes, hey, we're getting ready for another album, and we're going to do like a video shoot and all that stuff. She goes, I need like a poncho and a hat and all that kind of stuff. So, which, of course, if you look on the album, that's what he was wearing. So when he was on his way out, he just reached in his pocket and gave her that pic. And she knew that I was a big fan of Stevie Ray. By the way, I've met him like 12 times, believe it or not. Anyways. And I got stories about Stevie Ray. You can ask me later. Anyways, so he gave me that pig. So that pig was one of my favorite items, and it's gone. Anyways, so there you go. So does that answer your question? I don't even know. No, I never did answer your question. I have so many. No, I have so many artwork that when I was in high school, I would give some of my artwork away because people couldn't afford to pay for them. You know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I would just do that, you know, and every once in a while, I don't know, some friends, I would just give them away. And then, of course, when I was in the military, I was lucky that I did some artwork. And it was the same thing, you know. Sometimes it's just easy to let go of things when you're moving, I found out, because you don't want to carry them, you know. So I don't know, Raphael, I have no idea. Just several.
I'll be several. I'll be honest with you. That's kind of the answer I was expecting. Because in my brain, I was trying to, I guess, quantify like all the years of work, of artwork that you would have produced. But I'm like, I don't know that there's a way to measure that. But because I feel like you've gone through so many experiences, and I'm just like, you know, I'm sitting here listening and also thinking, oh, I can ask him about that. Oh, I can ask him about this. Mm-hmm. You were in the military. You've had all these experiences. You have an affinity for Stevie Ray Vaughan and his music, right? And so all of these different kinds of things, all of the artists that you've interacted with, the movements that you've been a part of over the years, specifically in Dallas and Oak Cliff, I could ask a million questions about all of that. And I feel like I'd get just an even broader view into the lifetime that you've had, which is so rich in experience.
Well, we know that there's more than 70. because that's about how many you brought into the Oak Cliff Cultural Center, and with the intention of just looking at them and seeing which ones would go in the exhibit. I do have to say, though, I was surprised, I am a little bit sad about not getting to see some of these. Now, don't start unwrapping them right now, but I do wish that we had a bigger space that could accommodate a bigger show, because I know you have a lot of work and it would be great to see so much more of your work.
Well, you know what? I'm glad you said that. So everybody that's listened to us, if you just take, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 minutes and go, how can we get more walls for the Oak Cliff Culture Center? I mean, they would be great, because actually I was just, you know, saying to Iris and Andrea, we need more walls. Can you put some of the artwork on the ceiling? She's going, no, we're not going to do that. You know, and honestly, and believe it or not, I'm not making this up. I said, I didn't think I had enough work, because my brain just doesn't calculate things sometimes. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Iris said, well, think about some of the work that you have to have. I'm going, oh, I have to have all of them in the show, but I can't put them in, you know, but they're just the way I am. But because like I said before, it's easy for me, and I've done it before, to say, if you just stick to one particular theme, like, for example, I have literally taken, I'm not making it up, hundreds and hundreds of photographs of stone angels. I've been studying, you know, graveyards for, I don't even know how long. Because that was a big passion of mine, photography. By the way, see, I'm rambling here and there, like you didn't ask me, but there's a particular piece in the show, and it's called I Quit Painting in 1973, and it's a palette, some old brushes, and some tubes of oil paint. Again, Raphael, tears in the beers, man. It's a sad story. I've got sad story for everything, you know, and that reminded me, when I came out of the Army, I just didn't know what was going on, you know, really. So I like, and I felt really out of place, because I had been gone for 2 years, you know. But I knew that I still enjoyed doing art, but I hadn't met anybody at the Culture Center at that point or anything, so I didn't know what to do with my art. Well, I met these two particular individuals who kindly offered some space in a bar, which, looking back, that was not a good idea. I said, well, maybe somebody will buy my art and stuff. So I took some paintings. And you know what? And I really, now that I think about it, I really, really like those paintings, because sometimes I like to challenge myself. And remember, I was doing oils for the longest time. I started in high school. So my challenge was, and said to myself, Jose, in these next three paintings, what I need to do is do a painting without, I don't want you to show people, I don't want people to see the brush strokes. So that was my challenge, you know. And so I did that, and you know, and I really worked hard at it, but I was really proud of my pieces. So when somebody said, hey, you can put them at the bar, I said, sure. I want people to come and see the work and everything. Well, I missed my painting, so I went back like 2 weeks later, went to the bar, and I said, hey, I'm here for my paintings. And they go, what paintings? Oh. I said, you know, the paintings that are, you know, they're on the wall. He goes, we don't have any paintings on the wall. I go, yeah, right. Well, wait, where's my artwork? He goes, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, no, stop kidding around. I brought my paintings into, and we put them, but he goes, look, I don't know what the hell you want. I don't have your paintings, so just get out of here. I mean, if you want a beer, drink a beer, but if, we don't know what the hell you're talking about, just get out. And he was serious, and I went like, what am I going to do? Call the police. What do they care? Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. What's that, Mr. Vargas? You said that they misplaced your paintings. Do you have proof of it? Well, no, I don't. So I'm going, no. I didn't call the police. So, but I was so traumatized. I'm going, to me, I don't want to describe some of the things that could be traumatizing, but let's just say it was bad. It was like somebody had just kicked me in the stomach several times. So I went, but I knew there was nothing I could do about it. But then I just realized how bad people were out there. And they decided to steal my paint, which meant a lot to me. You know, when artists do artwork, and I've told other people about that, because sometimes they'll go, hey, is your artwork for sale? Not right away. Well, why not? I said, well, okay, I know this sounds weird. It sounds crazy. But sometimes when an artist creates a piece of artwork, it's like you're having a baby. Mm-hmm. That is your creation. This is your child. Mm-hmm. You're not ready to let it go. Not all the time, of course. Sometimes you go, yeah, I've knocked out 10 or whatever. But anyways, so I went home, and I was so traumatized that I just opened up the closet door, and I took all my brushes and my tubes. I had my tubes of paint in this wooden box, and I just put it in there, and I closed the door. I knew that when I was closing the door, I knew that it was symbolic of me closing the door, and that was it. But honestly, this sounds crazy, but I felt like my arms, my hands, they were just cut off. Mm.
I want to hear, because I've heard the stories about, I want to go back to your photography, and especially since you were talking about, like, you know, stopping painting for 30 years, and which is, you know, what that piece is based surrounding. I want to hear more about, like, your passion for photography, and then also kind of talk to us about, like, you worked in a photography lab for many years.
Yeah, over 15 years.
Yeah, what was that like? I mean, is that kind of like you were interested in photography already, and you were making photographs, and you were able to get that job? And what did that feel like, being able to, you know, process these, like, you know, you're out making photographs, and you're, you know, making your own work, printing it, and then I know this about working, you know, like in a lab with other students or fellow artists, but seeing other people's images, and like, kind of talk about like that and what that's like.
Oh, before I answer your question, I'm going to go, so how many hours did you set aside for this podcast? Because, you know, I've got 200 yeah. or 2,000
stories. Yeah, we're
here till
tomorrow.
Yeah.
Oh,
till the opening tomorrow.
We usually find a stopping place, but we knew this was going to be a lot of good stories.
Well, mm-hmm. well, terrific, because actually what just popped into my brain, which is a scary idea, I just remembered in the 70s, I think 75, 76. Well, I was going to Central College. Across the street from Central College was a bar called Talbert's Texas Chili Powder and Museum of the Chili Culture. Well, I went over there because, you know, a friend of mine, we just wanted a beer, you know, and the beers were cheap. I think, you know, anyway, so we just went there to have a beer. And the guy, Frank Talbert Jr., he comes over to me and to my friend, and he goes, hey, to my friend, he goes, hey, do you want to make a couple of bucks? He goes, huh, what? What are you talking about? She goes, hey, my bus boy just quit. I need somebody to bust the tables, but I need it, like, right away. He goes, look, I'll tell you what. I'll pay you X number of dollars. You can have all the beer you want, and I'll give you whatever you want on the menu for free. I just need your help for, like, 45 minutes. Are you interested? She goes, sure. So she got up and she looked at me and she goes, I got to go to work. I said, all right, sure, no problem, you know. So I went there the next day and he goes, where's your friend? I go, what? Your friend? I need somebody to bust it. He goes, what are you doing right now? Me? I go, yeah, yeah. He goes, look, it's easy. Just get a box, put the beer bottles in there, wipe off the table, and move on. It's pretty simple. Same thing. You can have all the beer you want, anything that menu you want. I'm not going to charge you for it, and I'll pay you for it. I won't tell you what else you said because, well, you know, I'm a cane. But anyways, but he did make another offer, which I thought, well, that sounds pretty good, you know? So believe it or not, that little, I just wanted to help him out. It actually turned into a 2-year extension. That was another part of my one of my adventures. So now I was doing art at the Central College, and I was working for the college. I was the sign printer, using wood, you know, metal and wooden things, and they didn't have enough letters, and you would have to do the signs 2 or 3 times because the letters were missing and all that kind of stuff, which was, I thought, was kind of ridiculous. But at the same time, but now I loved eating, you know, chili and burgers and stuff, and they were free. So here I was, and it was easy. I mean, how easy can it be? Just putting beer bottles in a box and wiping off the table, and I was getting paid. So I started doing that, and come to realize that that place attracted all kinds of people: criminals, lawyers, judges, poets, artist, musician, you name it. I mean, it was just crazy. So I got to meet so many artists, so many musicians, you know, people that weren't even famous. Stevie Ray Vaughan, Jimmy Vaughan, the Fabulous Thunderbirds, you know, Paul Rain, the Cobras, all these people. The manager, he was from Austin. He goes, hey, I know a bunch of guys in Austin. Hey, he goes, I got an idea. Why don't we have a big party? They'll come over, they'll play for free. They'll just play for the door. And we have a big party. What do you think? We went, hell yeah, let's do it. So sure enough, these people were coming in. And so it opened up my eyes. Well, first of all, you know, I haven't got to your question yet. So I was looking at these people, you know, like Stevie Ray Vaughan. And, you know, he was young. As I said, none of them were famous. They were working for a $2.50 cover at the door. That's what they were working for, you know. But I was extremely impressed with the talent of these individuals. But I liked the way everything was just kind of flowing in, you know, with a mixture of people. And so I was meeting artists and photographers. Oh, now I remember why I started telling you about that. So Frank Talbert Jr., Frank Talbert number 2, by the way, he just died recently, you know. May God rest his soul. But he was a crazy artist, and I really liked what he was doing. But he was his girlfriend, Anne Starkberg. She was a well-known photographer. I think she still is. Anyways, she saw that I was working with these crappy little brownie cameras because I couldn't afford a real camera. And she says, Jose, have you ever thought of using a 35mm camera? I said, yeah, but I can't afford one. She goes, I'll let you borrow one of my cameras. I said, are you kidding me? She goes, no. I said, I don't know how to use those things. They're too complicated. She goes, oh, no, it's easy. This is the point that I was trying to tell you. She goes, look, she goes, I'm going to load up the film for you. Look, it's really simple. See, you put your finger on here, which was the lens. She goes, and you turn it this way, and you turn it that way. You've got your eye to the little window. When it's in sharp, in focus, You're set. All you got to do is press your finger on this button right here. Yeah. You press the finger, it's going to click. You use your thumb and you move it over. And you're ready for your next picture. Easy, huh? And I'm going, yeah. She goes, and you don't have to worry about anything. I already set it up for you. Now go out there and take some pictures. And when you come back, I'll take the film out and I'll reload it for you. And you can keep it over the weekend. I said, what? Man, I mean, I started, you know, when I'm saying, like, man, a 35mm camera, I was like, you know, I had been promoted. No more brownie cameras. I had been promoted. So I've always remembered that. I've always remembered that, you know, that little, you know, your fingers and click. And so, but it helped me a whole lot. And that's kind of what started, even though I had been interested in photography ever since I was a kid. All my sisters, they always use those cheap little brownie cameras where you have the little, some maybe people going, what's he talking about? I don't know. You know, the plastic black, and they had a little window that was red plastic, and there was numbers behind there. You had to stop at a number. That way you know what number you're on. Let's say you had 12 exposures. You're on number 12. That's the last one. You knew you had to roll it back up, you know, and go and turn in and get it developed. Anyways, my sisters, we did that. And I really enjoyed watching what pictures they were taking. Of course, I kind of enjoyed being a ham and being in the photographs and mm-hmm. stuff. Oh, I don't have time to tell you some of the weird stories that I did have with photography on the walls. But let me tell you, that was very scary for me. But anyways, so that kind of started my interest in photography. So here I am working at Talbert's Ride as a busboy, because I really enjoyed doing what I was doing, even though I was doing art at El Centro College. And I ran across this guy, and he says, "Hey, man, we need some help at a photo lab. You want to make some money?" And I go, "What do you do?" He goes, "Man, it's easy. You just go there. They train you what buttons to push on a machine, and you make these pictures, and you turn them in. They get to develop, and they'll pay you X amount of dollars. And you only have to work like 4 days a week." And I like the hours. I would start at 12:45 in the afternoon, and I would get out around like 12:30 at night, whatever, and we only work for, I said, "Wow, this is great." As soon as I get out of work, we would go straight to the bar, you know? And they had dropped the cover by that time. Plus, yeah. I already knew all these musicians, so mm-hmm. I knew who to go and see around Dallas. So I was seeing, you know, again, Stevie Ray Vaughan, the Cobras, and Fabulous Thunderbirds. And so I would get to know people at the door. They would go, "Yeah, come on in, Jose, come on," you know? And I said, so it was great. You know, it was just a great time in my life. Now, mind you didn't ask me about this. Mind you, this is the 70s. I was renting a house for my father, who he bought for $3,000. I was renting it for $90 a month. He raised the rent because I had two girls move in with me. So he raised the rent to $130. But then when the girls moved out, he didn't lower the price. I still had to pay $130 a month. I was kind of miffed at that, you know. But anyway, but I didn't have a telephone. I couldn't afford it. I didn't have air conditioning. I couldn't afford it. And I didn't have a TV because I couldn't afford it. But I had beer. Well, wait, I didn't even have a refrigerator for a while, so I had to put the beer in my father's refrigerator. But you know what? He would drink my beer. He would, which I said, you know, this isn't working out, you know. So anyways.
But you had beer, burgers, and a camera.
I had the one camera that I had borrowed from her, and I had, you know, I could afford to buy film. But anyway, but that guy, he turned me on to getting this job at a photo. Yes, it was the only for Christmas, you know, because, you know, Christmas, everybody.
Yeah.
So, you asked me about that, but I walked in, and you can imagine all of these people that work in these little rooms, and they're all, like, pushing buttons and stuff, and all I had to do with numbers and things, and it was easy enough. But then you walked into the area where the film, the photographs are being developed, and also lots and lots and lots of machines, and they're all running constantly. Mm-hmm. And so you're literally seeing hundreds and hundreds and thousands of photographs. Well, can you imagine what that did to my brain? My mind started getting overloaded because I would see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of pictures, but my brain wanted to look at each picture. Mm. And so for the first 6 months that I worked in the lab, I wasn't getting any sleep at night because when I would go to sleep at night, my brain would go into overtime and it would see all these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of pictures that were moving constantly. So I did that all night long. So when I would wake up in the morning, I was tired. I really was tired. And after 6 months, I'm going, I don't know what to do. I'm exhausted, you know, and I couldn't turn my brain off. I wanted to, but I couldn't. So, you know, I won't go into detail. Let's just say I had to numb my brain in a number of ways. But it was exhausting. But at the same time, it was just, I used to have the most amazing dreams where it was just unbelievable. The best dreams I ever had. They're so creative. They're so colorful. And for an artist, that means a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, that it just opens up, you know, all kinds of things. So. Mm-hmm. hope that answered your question.
Yes.
Well, that's making me think about how we've discussed that you are interdimensional, not only in your use of various mediums, but also in subject matter. And we've already heard how fun you are and what great sense of humor you have. So I wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit about how your sense of humor has it obviously comes across in your artwork, but how it's helped you in life, because you talked about a lot of sad stories that you could share with us, and also having to deal with death really early on in your life. And also, when I think about interdimensional, I think about traveling to outer space and light years and things like that. And we know that there's a piece in the show that has a UFO in there. So
several pieces with the UFO theme.
Yeah, well, which of course, you know, I'm going to tell you about my first UFO experience. Well, I don't know if that was my first one. Okay, let me tell you this. When I was growing up, I used to have some very strange experiences. Oh, I got to tell you about the TV, right?
Okay. Let's do the TV.
I'm 7 years old. It's 1957. But my father, he buys a TV. Now, most of you listening to us, you know, this was like 100 years ago. But the TVs back then, they were not in, I don't even know when color TV came out. But the boxes, they were old tubes, but the wooden boxes, they were big. But the screen was really small. And my uncles had the same thing. I mean, they're really small. Now, I know this is going to sound really goofy, and I'm sure it is really goofy, but I'm telling you, my brain is very peculiar. I didn't know what a TV was. Honestly, I had never seen a TV, so my father brings in a wooden box, right? And he plugs it in, he turns it on, and I'm blown away because there's little people inside a box. And I'm really mesmerized by that. I'm going, those are the smallest horses I had ever seen. And then I'm going, how did they go inside the box? Because I never saw them going inside the box. Mm-hmm. I know, I'm telling you, I know it sounds crazy, but that's what I was thinking. I'm going, so I decided, because I am an inquisitive individual, I decided to crawl behind the TV, and I'm really lucky I didn't get electrocuted. But I really was looking for a door. I'm assuming there was a door or a window or a set of stairs where the little people and the little horses outside would come in into the box, because I saw them. They were inside the box. So I was trying to figure out how they get inside, but I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't see anything except tubes and wires back there. So for 2 or 3 days, I was completely mesmerized by this wooden box. Of course, my mom said it was the devil's work, and which I think later on, I think I will tell you about another experience where I'm going, yeah, I think she's right. But I didn't think it was the devil's work. I just thought I was seeing magic, which I was, I think, you know. But anyways, then 1 or 2 days later, he buys a brand new 57 Chevy Bel Air. Well, I looked at it, I thought, it's nice looking, but not as interesting as the little people and the little horses inside the wooden box. I still was trying to figure out how that happened, and I never could figure it out. But anyways, so you see, that's how my brain works. Mm-hmm. But I know it sounds crazy, but it had such a strong impact on me that I started hallucinating. My sisters, being teenagers, they would have pictures on the wall. Elvis Presley, Selminio, blah, 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 whatever. And so me, being the age that I was, I would come in, you know, from whatever, and I would look at the pictures because, well, you know, I'm a visual person. I'm going, wow, I like that picture, and I like this picture, and I like this other picture. Now, I know you didn't ask me about this, but but then I started realizing that the pictures were starting to move. Slowly, I'm not making it up. I swear I'm not making this up. They're like their eyes, their eyelids would flash up and down. And I'm going, that's interesting. And then slowly, I mean, very slowly, they would start moving their heads back. And then, mind you, to me, I was having a hallucination. these were 3D. Their lips started moving, their started moving their heads. But then it got really scary because they started cussing me out. They would say this, really bad things.
This wasn't in the 70s, right?
No. This was in the 50s. Okay. Yeah, when I was about 8 or 9 years old. There's no drugs involved.
No.
but they were really...
You told me a story before. It's not like that one, but I remember you telling me it was in the 70s, but I felt like you were communicating with something, but I remember you vividly telling me it was the 70s.
Well,
this was a different...
No, I communicate with a lot of things I have ever since I was a child. But anyways, I was afraid. I was afraid of these people that were in the pictures because they had me in a trance. I was already in a trance because... Well, I don't know why, but they had me in a trance. But I was scared, so I couldn't move. I couldn't run. But my sisters would come in, and I would say, make them stop. And they're going, what? They're going, that picture, don't you see them? Look at them. Don't you hear them? They're making bad things. They're threatening me. You don't see them? And they're going, no, which one is it? That one, where? That one right there. And they would go, and they would take it off the wall. And they would put it on the table. As soon as they did that, boom, I was out of the trance. I'm going, that was awful. I'm going, you didn't see them moving? They're going, no, Jose, stop staring at the photos. All right. Mm-hmm. Of course, 1 or 2 days later, same thing. I'd be coming in. I'm going, wow, look at those photographs. I really like those photographs. And then after a while, we're like, ooh, here we go again. You know, that went on for like months. You see what I'm saying? And you know what? It took me literally, I believe it or not, it took me over 50 years to figure out what happened. Mm-hmm. Why did that happen? Mm-hmm. The TV. The TV, there were moving objects.
Yeah.
Which I never could figure out where the objects came from.
Yeah.
And my mom told me that it was the devil's work. And I didn't believe her until one Saturday afternoon when they used to show these monster movies. Mm-hmm. And Lon Chaney, I don't know if you heard of Lon Chaney.
Yes,
Lon
yes.
Chaney turned into the werewolf. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, none of us knew that he was going to turn into the werewolf, mm-hmm. right? We were just watching a movie, a black and white movie. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a full moon. And he starts growing hair on his face. And he started growing fast. Well, all of us got scared. So none of us wanted to go near the TV because we were afraid Lon Chaney was going to get us. So we said, Mom, can you turn off the TV? She's going, oh, no, I'm not getting near that thing. I told you it was the devil's work. So we saw the devil as far as I was concerned. We were seeing the devil, but all of us were afraid. And then they came out to commercial, and then we ran up to it, and we turned it off. And she goes, and don't turn it back on. No, we won't. Of course, an hour later going, we're kind of bored. Let's turn on the TV. Maybe the devil is gone. Oh, do you want to hear a story about the devil?
If there was ever... I think we found the name of your next show, Jose.
Do you want to hear a story about the devil?
Yeah, you want to hear a story about the devil.
Please,
I'm telling you,
please.
This is the way my brain works, and it hasn't stopped. When I was growing up in Post, Texas, that's, you know, near Lubbock, mm-hmm. and the town is stinky of oil. That's all mm-hmm. they does. You smell that stinky oil refinery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we were, I take it back. That was another, I've got stories. I won't bore you with those stories. No, in West Dallas, my mom used to go to a Baptist church. And I forget who this person was, but he would give shoes away, and he would have these trailers, trucks full of stuff, and it was mostly for, you know, the Hispanics, the Chicano Latinos. We were kind of poor. We grew up poor. I swear, we grew up poor. Anyways, so my mom said, "Yeah, the kids need some shoes and stuff, so we go to this place." Anyways, so she took me one day. I don't even know where it was, when it was. She took me one day, but. But get this, like, people don't explain things to me. They just go, come with us. All right, you know, you're a kid, sure, let's go. So all I know is that we walk into this huge room, right? See it from my perspective. You're a kid, right? You're a kid. Uh-huh. I don't even know how short you are. You're a kid. Of course, all the people are huge and everything is big. So all I know is that I'm in this room, everybody is sitting on these wooden benches, and everybody is looking forward, right? But at the end, at the very end, I swear there was the devil. There was a man whose face was really pale, and he was wearing a red suit. Mm-hmm. And my mom warned me about the red, you know, about the devil being red and how it exists. I said, oh my God, the devil is inside this room. And my mom wants me to go and say hi to it. And I'm going, no. And I'm yelling, no. And she's going, come on, come on, come on. And, you know, in Spanish, I couldn't understand why my mom was sacrificing me to the devil. Mm-hmm. But nobody explained to me that it was a Caucasian man in a Santa Claus suit. Mm-hmm. And I, believe it or not, had not seen that many Caucasian people in my limited world. And I'd never heard of Santa Claus or a Santa Claus suit. So I really thought it was the devil. So I really felt my mom was going to sacrifice me, and I was being betrayed, and I couldn't understand why I was deserving to be sacrificed to the devil. But it made a big impact on me. And he had blue eyes. And I've got blue stories about blue eyes, but I'll save those for some other time.
I mean, interesting perspective. It's like you're taking us on this journey, and then it's like, oh, and then I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Is Santa Claus the devil then?
Well, interestingly, this story reminds me of that you do have a piece with Santa Claus.
Yeah.
In the gallery, in this exhibition. So no, I'm not going to look at that piece again the same way. Because you've told me the story behind that piece.
Yeah, I did. And I can share that story with you. But I do want to say that, okay, I'm only going to give you just a little tidbits. I did actually see Santa Claus flying in the air. And I know people don't believe me, but I'm telling you, when I was a kid, I saw all kinds of things that were just unworldly. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you a story about my dead grandmother going to the kitchen. That's one of my favorite stories. Mm-hmm. And by the way, she's on this play, not her entirely, but she's in one of the photographs. So I'm telling you, I've got hundreds of stories, but I'm telling you, some of these stories are just scary because I was just scared out of my mind. I really thought, you know, something bad was going to happen, you know, so...
Anytime I talk to you from this day forth, Jose, I just hope you're aware that I'll probably be recording our conversations. Just because I feel like you mentioned earlier about people referring to you as in some kind of archivist. But I think some of these stories deserve a lot more attention than just a conversation between you and the Cultural Center staff.
I was just thinking, like at the beginning when we first started talking, and earlier we were recording with a comedian, Paolo Firo, and I was thinking, man, Jose has, I think, got some of the same, I don't know who you want to call it, like tendencies towards, you know, the humor just the ability to make people laugh without necessarily telling a joke, you know, like a, you know, like your normal run of the mill joke. I thought, wow, we've been able to laugh today.
And the way and the tone in which you deliver this information, I'm like, oh, at the end, I'm like, he was talking about Santa Claus. But if anyone else had told that story, I'd have been like, that would be the end of it. I'd be like, oh, they were talking about Santa Claus. But here I am in conversation with Jose, and I'm like, oh, it's Santa Claus. Or is it? Or what, is there this global conspiracy to seep the devil into modern American culture?
Yes.
Through, you know?
Well, you know, I have heard that the devil does want to
Happy holidays, y'all.
No, but basically, what I'm telling you, this is why I create the art that I do, because my brain is just so full of misery and despair. But yeah, there's a few highlights in there, you know, here and there. And not every artwork that I do has something to do with some strangeness. Some of it is just goofing around. Like, for example, if you look at some of the artwork that I have of the people wearing a green mask, to me, One of the things that I do well, and that I feel that I do well, is art. But I always thought of art as a panacea. It when you're doing art, your mind is somewhere else. Sometimes I really feel we're not even physically, even though we're not even in our physical bodies. You're somewhere away. In other words, you make time slow down or stop. You take the pain. If you're in pain, you don't feel the pain because you're not there. You're somewhere else because you're creating art. See, and I'm the kind of person, and I know it's probably a lot of things that I say may sound odd to people, but I'm the kind of person that sometimes I allow the art to communicate with me. They tell me stories, I listen to them, and so I try to create the art to fit their particular needs. Not all of them, but some of them. Like if you look at some of the artwork, I might have a few, I don't have that many, where they say you might have a skeleton playing a guitar, mm-hmm. stuff like that. Well, I really would get into it to where I wanted to understand that character. And sometimes, for example, like I would be doing a painting, you know, and I'm like, for example, a rose. I would paint a rose. And I said, well, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, the rose is going to be pink or red. And I got the paints laid out and I got the brushes ready and I've already drawn the design. So my hand, I thought I was going to use red paint, but no, my hand, it's not listening to my brain. My hand moves on its own and it picks up a brown paint. So I'm going, oh, well, I guess I'm using a brown paint. So you see what I'm saying? It's sort of like, so sometimes I don't know what's taking place, but that's how I do things. I get into the zone, and first of all, I don't like people talking to me or interrupting me when I'm doing my art because I'm in the zone, you know, mm-hmm. and that's where I like to be. So most of the time, I wish I could just, and I'm not that lucky, say, anybody out there listening to me, if you know how I can do it, please tell me, how can I be so lucky to where all I do is do my art all day long and all night long? I don't do anything else. I don't mow the lawn. I don't worry about getting the car inspected. I don't worry about going and paying, you know, whatever. I don't even want to go to the grocery store. I just want to do my art. And I haven't mm-hmm. figured out how to do it. I'm 73 years old. I haven't figured out how to do it, but I do enjoy my art, and I feel very lucky to show my artwork at mm-hmm. the Oak Cliff Cultural Center. Does that answer your question, Iris? I don't know where it is.
I've forgotten already. I got lost in the story.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Oh, man. I feel like, how many more hours we have?
Well, we have to finish. We have to finish some things. I know we have some things
coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah, do we have any pressing things that we... Man, I feel like I have so many questions, but I'm like, I need to... I'll save it for the reception or throughout the run of your exhibit. I'll mm-hmm. wander in there. And if you happen to be here at the Cultural Center, we'll chat about some things that came up specifically, you know, during the course of this conversation, but also just things I feel like I've had in the back of my mind. And honestly, this show, I'm happy to see it because a lot of the work I haven't seen. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I've known you for 12 years, but this exhibit of your work is different than some of the things that I've seen in the past, different enough to where it's like, oh, wow. You know, that there are things that I either thought about a long time ago and abandoned because I didn't want to ask you, or thinking about new ways of interpreting some of your work. So yes, you'll get, I'm sure, a flurry of questions from me, mm-hmm. if not from, you know, any of the other OC3 team members or people that will just be here at the reception or at the show. So yeah, if we have nothing else, thank you, Jose, for, you know, spending your afternoon with us and toughing through this week. It's been a really like whirlwind of a week, and we appreciate you kind of, working with us and trusting us to be able to, you know, get everything together. Mm-hmm. You've seen how amazing our team is. So, we do appreciate your patience with us. And for those listeners, Jose Vargas's Retromático 3 opens December 9th. And if you're listening to this after, which you probably will be, it runs through...
Runs through January 12th. Mm-hmm. That might be wrong.
13th.
Yeah, January 12th.
January 12th.
Yeah, January 12th. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So you have some time to see it.
You have some time to see it. We will be closed.
Yes.
December 24th.
So the week between Christmas Eve holiday and New Year's
and
Day.
New Year's Day. But yes. Then we'll be back after that, Tuesday through Saturday, noon to 6,
for
gallery hours. And I've heard that Jose is known to be present at his shows after the reception. So you might get lucky if you come in and get to talk to the artist. If you come after, during one of those days after the reception.
Yeah.
But don't take any chances. Try to get here for the reception.
And also, I mean, make sure that you stop by the Latino Cultural Center during the run of the Virgen de Guadalupe exhibit. And make sure you make plans to go visit the Corazon exhibit once it opens at the Bathhouse Cultural Center. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, again, this has been OC3 Frequencies, a podcast by the Oak Cliff Cultural Center. We are a division of the City of Dallas Office of Arts and Culture. We cannot thank Jose Vargas enough, so we appreciate you for coming in. Make sure you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or SoundCloud. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure you give us 5-star reviews. We love hearing feedback, so if you have any questions, concerns, comments, or any ideas, make sure you send them our way. We love hearing that kind of stuff. We do it for the community and the City of Dallas. And arts and culture at large. So wherever you might be listening and you have a cool idea or concern, make sure you send us a note. Again, thank you all so much for listening to OC3 Frequencies. We'll catch you on the next one. Bye, y'all.
Bye.